This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. We have a special interview pod today, Kieran, which I'm a big man, so I've agreed to carry on doing this pod, even though you greeted me by saying, "Hello, Paul," when we just got back. We did the interview this morning, then you had to go and do some work, and then I came back out of the goodness of my own heart to record this introduction. "Hello, Paul," says you, after 4.5 years of the most successful, groundbreaking football finance podcast there's ever been, and suddenly I'm Paul.
It's been quite a traumatic day. There's been a lot of football finance stories, and I started off the day trying to explain the new variant of financial fair play to Alan Brazil on TalkSport. So that was quite a challenging exercise, as you can imagine.
Oh my God, what time was that?
That was about 7:15.
Good Lord. Well, I don't envy you. Perhaps did he at any stage explain to you why he's still working for TalkSport after our interview, Ken? I always feel a little bit, guilty towards our other interviewees that we've had in the past, all of which I've enjoyed, when I say that I was slightly blown away by this next interview, Kieran. It's an interview with Tom Behan, with his brother, co-founded the sportswear brand Castor, which makes kit for clubs like Newcastle United, Aston Villa and Rangers. He was, I think, as you said, Kieran, everything we aren't, which we would discuss after this interview. But I think our listeners will agree with me, Kieran, it's well worth listening to. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. Before we talk about the remarkable rise of Castori, tell us a little bit about yourself and your life before all this madness happened.
Yeah, no, great to be here, Kevin, Kieran. Thanks very much for having me on, guys. So, I'm born and raised in Merseyside, where I guess sport is, alongside music, quasi-religion. Like, the depth of passion for sport in Merseyside runs incredibly deep. So I was in no way unusual as a young lad growing up in Merseyside in wanting to be a professional footballer. Unfortunately for me, my talent did not match up with my ambitions as a footballer. So I played for Merseyside's third team, the mighty Tranmere Rovers. Signed a professional contract at 16. The manager who offered me that professional contract, Brian Little, who had a very successful career as a manager, promptly got fired. I don't know if he got fired, actually, or left of his own accord, but left quickly thereafter. A new manager came in. I was not his type of player, which is an incredibly common thing in football generally, and certainly the lower leagues. So despite signing a professional contract, didn't actually play professionally. Got to the age of 22, which is obviously young in the real world, but is positively middle-aged in the world of elite sport. And whereas most people have a sob story that involves an injury or some kind of terribly bad luck, I don't have that. I just realised that I wasn't good enough to make it at the highest level. And if I wanted to be successful in life, I would have to go off and do something else. So made that decision. Fortunately for me, I've got a brother who was equally mediocre in his chosen sport, which was cricket. And between us, we've got kind of no entrepreneurial background in the family whatsoever. Our mum was a teacher. Our dad worked in construction. But between Phil, my brother, and I, we said, yeah, we're not going to make it as athletes. What are we going to do with our lives? Let's start a business, which was part ignorance, part naivety. But there you go. 8 years later, here we are.
Yeah. As this pod is presented by two Londoners, Tom, I'd like to point out that it's you that said Tranmere were Merseyside's third team. Because otherwise we're the ones who get the angry tweets. Yeah, I'm particularly intrigued by this, Tom. Before we come on to more detail about how you grew the company, you started online, obviously, but now you're opening more and more actual shops. Why is that? And is it working in the current economic climate?
So to answer the second question first, yes, it is. Our stores, I mean, we always have been, which I think comes back to the kind of genesis of how we started Castor, where we didn't have any money. It was very much pull yourself up by your bootstraps, which I know sounds cliched, but it was the reality in our case. And kind of when you go through that, and any entrepreneurs listening to this, I suspect it will resonate deeply with them that when you've been through that, it becomes deeply ingrained in your soul, kind of focused on profit. I know, Kieran, kind of revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, cash flow is reality. That, maybe I couldn't have said it quite as eloquently as you, but that mindset becomes deeply embedded. So for us, the stores have to be profitable. The economics of retail have changed post-COVID. So pre-COVID, all of the leverage sat with landlords, that they would force tenants to sign up to long-term leases. Generally, there was upward only rent reviews, very difficult kind of to get out of the lease if it wasn't going well. It was penal. It was hard to open stores unless you were very confident it was going to be successful, which of course, when you're starting out, is difficult. In a post-COVID economy, and of course this has been well documented, the growth of e-commerce, but one of the outputs of that is the leverage has moved far more towards tenants and away from landlords, and you can now have far more flexible leases. More of the rent is linked to revenue rather than a fixed cost, so it's become a lot more economically attractive, combined with the fact that I guess we as entrepreneurs saw that post-COVID world opening up again, people enjoy shopping. It's a very social thing to do. I was in San Francisco recently, where kind of a lot of people talk about the ongoing digitization of the world and this view that we're all going to live on AR headsets and never actually speak to each other, like personally. And probably you wouldn't be too intelligent to bet against Mark Zuckerberg, but personally, I just don't see that happening. I've always felt that people want to interact. That physical experience is really important. So that those two elements together led us to opening up stores, and they have worked well. And there'll always be a balance. I always think e-commerce and digital will be the engine of Castor's growth. But I definitely see that mix being very important.
Do you know what? It breaks my heart, Tom, walking down my local high street to see how few shops are actually open compared to how it was even 10, 20 years ago. You mentioned pre and post COVID, Tom, but you've been honest enough to admit recently that the pandemic was actually quite good for your business, wasn't it, at the time?
It was very good. And I mean, we've been described, Kevin, and it kind of raises my eyebrows in a trying to, kind of humorous way, I suppose, but someone has described us as an overnight success. And I was like, Jesus Christ, it didn't feel like an overnight success when I was moving back in with my mum and dad as all of my friends were buying houses and kind of paying yourself £1,000 a month for the first couple of years while you try and get the business off the ground. And yeah, kind of an overnight success, 10 years in the making type thing. But certainly COVID was an inflection point for Castor in that we'd started the business digital first. So we'd built up that infrastructure, that capability, hopefully a strong level of expertise. And I guess if you can think back to those dark days of kind of Q1, Q2, 2020, everyone had to shop online. There was no other way to purchase anything. And one of the very few times that all of us were allowed to leave our homes was to go and participate in exercise. So everyone was doing their Joe Wicks workouts or going for their walk a day. So if you couldn't sell fitness wear online during that period, you probably didn't deserve to be in business. So we were fortuitous by the circumstances that presented themselves, but we tried really hard to capitalize on those circumstances and grow the business in a way that probably wouldn't have been achievable had COVID not happened.
See, you say 10 years is a long time, Tom, but for somebody like me with a non-business background, that seems like a remarkable short space of time to get the success you've had. Is it possible to quantify how steep the learning curve was from when you first started off around that kitchen table in your parents' house to where you are now?
Yeah, that is an incredibly interesting question, Kevin. And I suppose the first thing to say, and again, kind of, I'm sure there'll be people listening to this with whom this point resonates. When you're an entrepreneur, when you start a business, there's no training wheels, there's no safety net. I did before, between stopping playing football and starting Castor, I spent a short period in the finance world. So I did leverage finance for a bank for a period, basically because I didn't have any money and I needed somebody to start Castor. So being the highly intelligent individual that I am, I thought, I know, bankers get well paid. I'll go and do that for a couple of years. But in any corporate environment, there is a manager, there's someone to check your work and mark your homework and make sure that you haven't made any silly mistakes. You don't get kind of put in front of clients without having someone to oversee you and help you if it gets difficult. Being an entrepreneur is the complete antithesis of that. So from day one, you're in circumstances that you haven't encountered before. There's a million books written about growing a business, starting a business, scaling, but you will every day face situations that you don't know what the answers are. So you just have to think on your feet, work it out. And that's incredibly difficult, I guess, for a lot of people. But entrepreneurs, I genuinely don't think they're necessarily any kind of intellectually better than anyone else, but they will have a different risk appetite and they will have a different appetite for pain, for want of a better word, stress, hardship, difficulty. So the learning curve is incredibly high. Equally, you're so used to it since you start the business. That's all you've ever known. So when it comes to launching a partnership with Andy Murray, launching a partnership with Rangers, these are these huge things that, again, there's no case study that you can read about how to do that effectively. Equally, there was no case study how to start the business in the first place or get from zero to £1,000 revenue, £100,000, £1,000,000. So the mindset of, here's a challenge, we've just got to work it out and overcome it, that again becomes very deeply embedded, which actually makes it ironically easier to go through these difficult things because you're so used to it.
I'm interested in that, Tom, because as somebody with no entrepreneurial instinct at all, I'm interested in how you start. And also, when you start, are you thinking to yourself, well, let's start a leisureware company and see where it goes? Or are you thinking to yourself, in 5 years' time, we want to be supplying Andy Murray and we want to be supplying Premier League football teams?
Yeah, so it definitely wasn't the latter. Like what's happened to Castor in the last 10 years, there was no scenario in my head that I could have expected any of it to happen, but being really honest. Equally, that's not to say that we weren't ambitious from the start, because we absolutely were. So I guess everyone's different. I don't think there's any singular route to starting a business and being successful. But for us, a big part of it, Kevin, was necessity. Like I didn't want my life to be how it was. I wanted my life to be better than how it was. Kind of failing as a professional footballer, I didn't want that to define me. So there was a real drive that I need to be successful. I'm going to make a success of myself no matter what. And it was that again, that wasn't an academic thing. That wasn't driven by market analysis or any sort of deep cerebral intellectual thinking. It was, I'm going to make a success of myself by any means necessary. And only thereafter, or upon that foundation, did the assessment or analysis come of, well, if I've got any chance of being successful and overcoming the difficulties and the setbacks and the hardships that are inevitable, I need to be really passionate about what it is that I'm doing. And the only thing that I'm passionate about is sport. So from that foundation came, I guess, a little bit more intellectual or analysis of, is there a gap in the market? Can you compete with Nike and Adidas? thinking ahead, because we knew that we couldn't go into team sports from the beginning. We didn't have the credibility. No team would trust us. But we did think about it at the start and say, is that market serviced as well as it could be? Do Nike and Adidas provide the best possible product service to every single team? And we felt clearly the answer to that was no. There therefore has to be an opportunity to do it better. Most people would be scared by that and say there's no way on earth you can compete with Nike and Adidas. But we felt if it's not working perfectly, why can't someone go in and try and do it?
So that raises an interesting question, Tom, and I know this is something Kieran's interested in. So when you first started to pitch for contracts with Premier League football clubs against the traditional big hitters like Nike and Adidas, what sort of competitive advantage could you offer to people like Villa and Newcastle that gave you the confidence that your pitch would be chosen rather than theirs?
Yeah, so I guess you start there, Kevin, by taking a step back and thinking about the market before Castor entered. So there had been very little innovation within the team sports landscape, really, for a generation. Like I'm 34, and as long as I can remember, this market has been dominated by Nike and Adidas, and it was a quasi-duopoly, and that's an opinion, not a fact. I don't want to get sued by the good people at those large companies, but it was certainly dominated by those two huge brands. And whenever you have a situation like that in any sector, it generally doesn't provide optimal outcomes for customers, essentially, because there's no real incentive for the status quo to innovate. Like, why would they innovate? They'd be innovating against themselves. So that landscape, we felt, was ripe for disruption. We felt that the incumbents had an identikit approach, whether it was to kit designs, whether it was to the channels through which they would sell products. The vast majority of sports merchandise historically had been sold through third-party retailers like JD Sports and Sports Direct. The world had digitized. More and more direct-to-consumer brands were being very successful, yet sport had been left behind in that sense. And in our view, Nike and Adidas focused their resources on a very small section of teams at the very top of the market. So kind of the top 2 or 3% of teams, essentially, because that was what was economically rational for them. Nike's 100, and the share price has come down a little bit this year, but $140 billion odd market capitalization. It's economically rational only for them to focus on teams at the very top that can move serious number volumes of product. So historically, the big brands had seen teams as billboards, marketing adverts for them to help them sell more trainers. They hadn't viewed them as individual brands that should be optimized. And I think this will resonate with Kieran from a finance perspective. If you think about the economics of sport, and you have to be careful here because fans don't like to think of themselves as customers, they're fans first and foremost, and sport is always incredibly emotive. But a finance person would say that football has incredibly attractive market characteristics. You have, and I'm using inverted commas here, captive audiences. Fans don't change the team that they support. That is true of almost no other consumer brand. So Louis Vuitton is one of the most powerful brands in the world, but most of their customers will also own a Chanel handbag. Apple is one of the most powerful brands in the world. Most of their customers will also own something from Intel or HP or Samsung. So that captive audience nature is a hugely powerful thing. You've got unique IP, intellectual property, to the point where football fans will get their team's logo tattooed on their bodies. That is not something that you see for Apple or Louis Vuitton, despite them being incredibly powerful brands. And then, of course, you've got the scarcity value that, as far as I know, they're not increasing the Premier League from 20 teams. So if you're in that elite, that has an inherent value because they're not creating any more. You cannot disrupt. There's very high barriers to entry. So all of those things make it a very attractive market. And the market, in our opinion, had not evolved. There hadn't been innovation around digitization, globalization, teams thinking strategically about how do we sell more products in the Middle East, in Asia, in North and South America. That led to a big opportunity for someone to come in and do something different. And I guess to answer your question directly, Kevin, how we kind of pitched ourselves differently, honestly, and this was just my experience thinking back 3 years ago, the market was delighted to have an alternative because it wasn't as if the market was working perfectly for everyone. So for Castor to come in, British brand, challenger brand, but most importantly, with a digital first focus to go and speak to teams and say, look, the world is digitizing, your fan bases are digitizing, the younger fans that you have will all engage with you via digital platforms. You need to think about this differently. You need to think with a more international and more ambitious focus. That was not something that Nike or Adidas were saying to them. So I would never say go as far as saying it was easy, because it definitely wasn't. But people were really receptive to that digital first innovation message.
I'm going to come back to the word disruption and disruptor later on, Tom, if you don't mind. But in the meantime, I saw Kieran nodding sagely at most of what you were saying there. I'd be interested in what Kieran has to say off the back of that.
I think that was absolutely fascinating from Tom. When you do have any market dominated by one or two parties, they become complacent. They focus on themselves rather than the customers. And what Tom, this is absolutely brilliant. You know, this is the stuff which we're always encouraging students to think about from a textbook point of view, but to hear it from a person that's been through that experience, for me, is absolutely sensational. It's the way to do it. It's to challenge the existing duopoly, and that's always a problem when you've got dominant parties in a market. But it takes somebody with big cojones to go into that and be prepared to be a disruptor. And fair play to you, Tom.
Or very stupid, Kieran. I don't know. maybe a combination of the two. But I think it's an interesting point you make about students. And I get asked the question a lot, because I didn't go to university. I left school at 16 thinking I'd be a professional footballer, and that would be the end of it. And I do think there is a really interesting balance between absolutely thinking about a market through the lens of how can I offer something different? How can my proposition be superior to the incumbents? But personally, having started a business and grown a business, that cojones point that you make, I know it's tongue in cheek, but the ability to suffer pain, to go to bed every night not knowing what revenue is coming in the door the next day, whether you're going to be able to pay your bills at the end of the month, that is maybe something that's hard to really articulate in a lecture theatre. That is something that you can only go through it to really understand it. But you are undoubtedly stronger for the experience. There's no doubt about that.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
I could talk to you about this for a long time, Tom, but we have other questions and we have time issues. But the amount of young comedians who say to me, you know, what do I do? How do I become a comedian? And I just say, A, you really, really, really want to have to love it. And B, all I can tell you is, because it's easy for me because I've come through it, all I can say to them is you just have to do it and do it and do it and do it. Because there's nothing, there is no secret. If everybody knew the secret to becoming a comedian, we wouldn't be telling them. But there is no secret. Tom, you also supply kit for rugby teams and for England cricket team. Most of our listeners would probably assume that given the relative economic state of those sports, there's much less margin for profit than in football. Would that be right?
So not margin, no, Kevin, in the sense that it broadly costs a similar amount to make a rugby shirt as it does a football one, a cricket one as it does a football one. And again, the prices are not massively different at the top end. So the margin is not so much. The volume of revenue or volume of product that you're going to sell is where the difference will be. So a Premier League football team will have most of them, and everyone thinks it's only the big four, which I know is kind of evolving into the quasi big six, that only those guys have international fans. That is not the case. We have the data. We run a lot of websites that tell us every hour of every day which countries we're selling these products in, and the vast majority of Premier League teams will have fans in multiple countries around the world. That is not yet true for rugby teams. That's not to say that it can't be the case, but it's far, far smaller. Rugby is followed, Premiership rugby will be followed by, I guess, expat communities in South Africa and Australia, and maybe a little bit in places like Dubai, but it's nowhere near the same volume as football, and that just shows the sheer, I guess, weight of power of the Premier League.
Tom, before we talk about the future for you and for Castor, which is looking rosy, I think we have to acknowledge that while your success story is incredible, it hasn't all been plain sailing for you recently. You know, I mean, it's a matter of public knowledge that Newcastle have issues with a deal with you. You know, people have been joking about the Villa kit being too heavy and so on and so forth. Could we get your take on those stories?
Yeah, of course. I mean, whatever you're doing, I guess we've used the word disruptive, haven't we, Kevin? Whenever you're trying to be disruptive, bumps in the road are inevitable. So I guess to Kieran's point earlier about kind of students and the difference between reading about it and doing it, going through those bumps, again, there's no way of coming through them other than to grit your teeth, bite down on the gum shield, so to speak, and come through them. So you firstly need to have a level of humility, and it is an interesting balance as an entrepreneur to be very ambitious, have huge, deep self-belief, but also have the self-awareness to acknowledge where you do need to improve. And I mean, we've grown Castor from zero to multiple hundreds, millions of revenue in a short space of time. You don't do that perfectly. No one does. So you do need to acknowledge where improvements can be made. And we've tried our best to do that. I did kind of say slightly tongue in cheek when I was asked by a journalist recently about has the Villa kit affected performance, and I don't know if it's the right response, but I said, well, if it has, we should do that for all of our teams, because Villa are having the best season that they've had for a very long time.
Fair point.
I guess there is a serious point that you have to learn from these things. You can't be hard-headed and say, oh no, that's not our fault. You do have to learn from them, which we've tried to do. Equally, I guess it's also true to say that all brands or teams change brand in this market. Well documented recently that the German national team have moved from Adidas after 77 years. A lot of noise at the moment about Barcelona and Nike. So if these things happen to Nike and Adidas, there's no logical reason why it shouldn't happen to Castor every now and then. It's a competitive market. We love to compete. We play to win. We generally win more than we lose, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be perfect, and you've got to learn from those experiences.
Yeah. You secured another big chunk of investment just last year. Presumably looking for new investors is a continuous process for you, is it?
No, you may be surprised, Kevin, to hear that no, it's not necessarily. I mean, I talked earlier about we've been very profit focused and cash focused from the beginning, which is very easy to say, and I promise you is incredibly, incredibly hard to do, particularly in sport where a lot of your revenue is linked to performance. And if a team qualifies for the Champions League, you'll sell more. If they lose a big game, you'll sell less. And managing working capital through that, particularly when you have kind of 50 plus teams as Castor now does, it is not easy. So being profit and cash focused is really important to us. And I say this as someone that has been rejected by every bank in the country and many of the investment community in the country. It's actually ironically easier to raise 100 million than it was to raise £1 million kind of back in the day, just because there's kind of different types of investors that focus on different opportunities, and that they're a lot more comfortable writing a bigger check than they are a smaller one, which is strange but true. So actually, once you get up to that level where we kind of raise not far off 150 million quid, which obviously is a lot of money, actually the question is more about who you're partnering with. There's a lot of people out there that can write a check for 150 million quid. I know it sounds strange to say, but it is the reality. So you're thinking about, well, is this person going to add value? Can they open doors strategically that maybe I can't open myself? Do they have the same values as me? Are they going to be long-term focused like I am? So for us, choosing to partner with Rain Group, who are really well known in this market, they kind of do a lot of sports deals, it was more about the people at Rain than it was about the money itself. And as we sit here today, I don't have any plans to go and raise more money. Equally, if you want to be a global brand, and our ambition is for Castor one day to be the British sportswear brand that competes on the global stage, Adidas and Puma are the German champions, Nike, and to a lesser extent Under Armour are the US champions. To my mind, Britain should have a champion that competes on the global stage. If we're going to achieve that ambition, probably at some point we'll need to raise a bit more money. But I've always taken the view, maybe old-fashioned, that if you build a really good, profitable, cash-generative business, there's going to be opportunities to raise money. You won't need to go and look for them.
Tom, I'm going to bring Kieran back in briefly here, because I'm not proud of my lack of business acumen. It just, my mind doesn't work that way. But when you were talking about being profit-focused and cash-focused, you got the double thumbs up from Kieran and a big smile. And somebody like me would assume that all companies should be profit-focused and cash-focused. So I'd like to know, Kieran, why you were so happy to hear Tom say that.
The reason why I was delighted to hear it is that I come across so many businesses where all the focus is just on sales, and they assume that everything else is going to fall into place as a result of that. And they don't look after costs, and they don't focus on cash. I was an insolvency specialist. You know, I was looking after businesses who had gone bust. And on so many occasions, and I won't name the companies or the industries, it's not fair to do so, they had a really successful product, but nobody was looking at what the overdraft was on a week-by-week basis or trying to do anything about that. And what Tom is doing is exactly the right thing. This is a textbook way of how to grow a business. And as Tom rightly said, if you're generating cash yourself, there's not many that many occasions when you're going to need to go to a market to raise more cash, unless you're looking for do a strategic step up as part of the overall growth ambitions of the institution.
I agree with all of that, Kieran. And it's a lot of it, Kevin, is driven by incentives. So 4 years ago, when interest rates were zero, investors would literally, it's not an overstatement, throw money at any business that was growing. To Kieran's point, you didn't have to be profitable. You didn't have to generate cash. If you were growing and you had a good sales patter and could talk, I'd never heard the acronym before, TAM, Total Applicable Market. If you could convince investors that you had a huge TAM for your product, people would throw money at you. Kind of fast forward 3-4 years, interest rates are a lot higher, investors are a lot more cautious. So there just isn't the incentive to focus just on revenue anyway, because you're not going to be rewarded for that. I do think particularly in the sports market as well, if you're not very, very careful and disciplined, your ego can run away with you. And there's a chance to do a partnership with, you mentioned earlier, the Liverpools, the Man Uniteds, the huge, huge teams. And if you were just focused on revenue, a partnership with those guys would very, very quickly grow your revenue. But as the founder of the business, I've got kind of north of 500 staff, and you're responsible for their ability to pay their mortgage every month and taking their kids on holiday this summer and their pensions. You cannot be driven by ego. That is only going to end one way, and it's not going to be positive. So there is always a balance as an entrepreneur between ambition, wanting to be ambitious, grow. That takes investment. You do need to take risks as you do that, but being very disciplined in how you go about it.
Does your continued success then, Tom, make you a target for those bigger companies that are still out there who say, well, rather than try and compete with these people, we'll try and buy them out?
It's interesting. Since we raised the money, Kevin, which we did last year, I've been asked more than ever before what my exit plans are. And I'm like, what? I don't have an exit plan. Why do I need to have an exit plan? This is my business. I was here at the start. I hopefully want to be there at the end. I've got nothing else I'd rather be doing with my life that makes me as excited and passionate as building Castor and trying to build a British sportswear champion does. So it does interest me that. But I guess whenever you force the status quo of a market to change, there will inevitably be pushback. And you see that all the time in the tech market, where someone will come up with a really clever technology or creative way of doing things, and Amazon, Google, Meta will instantly go and buy them out. So, I mean, we have a lot of knocks on the doors from weird and wonderful people interested in investing, acquiring, whatever, Castor. But until I have a conversation with someone that I think this will add real strategic value to the business and help us achieve our long-term ambitions, then I'm yet to be convinced that they would add value. But I think it's an interesting question in the sense that for Nike and Adidas, either you adapt and you say, okay, well, do we become more digital and do we partner with teams and help them grow their brands digitally and help them utilize data more intelligently? That is not easy for them to do. They are oil tankers. They have far more kind of pressing strategic priorities, which often involve selling their own products rather than teams' products. So either they adapt or they think about, well, yeah, can someone come in and do what Castor does? Again, that's difficult. There's very high barriers to entry in this market. The supply chain is very difficult. The operational infrastructure, I know I've got far more grey hairs on my head now than I did 3 years ago, because if you don't deliver a fan's product on time, it's a big thing. That's kind of a kid's birthday. That's their first experience. Like, that is a big thing. That is an emotional kind of thing that you wear. So that is not something that a lot of other companies can do. You have to be a credible brand in the sports market. There's a lot of talk 3 or 4 years ago about kind of the Chinese fashion brands looking to come into sport. And I know that they did a lot of analysis looking at it and decided against it because it is incredibly difficult. So we are in a very interesting market that has kind of big long-term secular growth drivers. Rather than thinking about kind of who could acquire us so that I can go and play golf every day, I'm not very good at golf. I'd rather be building Castor. So we're enjoying doing that at the moment.
I think my question, Tom, came from a layman's perspective in that, just as I assume everybody who buys a football club is doing it to make money out of selling it later on, I assume that most people who go into business are doing it to reach that stage where they can sell the business for a vast profit. But that's clearly not the case, is it?
No, it's interesting, Kevin, because I probably slightly unfairly and with a number of very high profile caveats, but I meet a lot of British entrepreneurs and I meet a lot of American entrepreneurs, and that there is a clear, distinct difference between the two parties. The Americans generally, they believe that they can take over the world. They believe that they can change the future. Sometimes it is quite funny to hear, but you're not going to change the future unless you believe that you can. It's a pretty good starting point. Whereas often, and again, not all, to be really clear, but often British entrepreneurs think, oh, if I can sell my business for X million or Y million, I'll go and buy a house in the Cotswolds and that will all be dandy. So again, I've got nothing against Cotswolds. It's a lovely place. Absolutely no prejudice against anyone who wants to do that. But for us, we kind of feel like we haven't come this far just to go this far. It's been so hard. There's been so many challenges and hardships. It's worth to us something that's far deeper than purely the financial, the chance to build a brand that is recognised and respected all over the world. That's what gets you out of bed at 5 a.m. every morning.
Just a couple more questions, Tom. You mentioned Nike there. What did you make of the manufactured outrage about the England shirt design? Was that the sort of publicity you'd kill for? And also, this is the moment when I ask you about what a disruptor is, because we saw that in Nike's press release that they aim to be a disruptor. Could you give a sort of definition for people like me of what a disruptor sets out to do?
Yeah, I guess the first part, I suspect, and I don't have any insight, but I suspect Nike were not too disappointed by the Fioro. It's people talking about them. It's their name in the media. Again, it's kind of strange for us to think this sat here in the UK, but the UK is one of many, many, many markets in which Nike operates. So I suspect they weren't overly disappointed by that. And then, yeah, it's a really interesting question. The definition of a disruptor to me is a group of people, someone, a group of people, a business that wants to do things differently, that wants to change a market and provide a product or service that is superior and different to anything that has come before it. So it's one of those terms that everyone will strive to be, of course, but it's far harder to be genuinely disruptive when you are the status quo than if you are an outsider looking in. When you're an outsider, as Castor was, and this will become more challenging to us as we become more established in the market, when you're an outsider, you have nothing to lose, so you have to disrupt. There's no choice, and that's always been our mindset at Castor. We have to wake up every day wanting to eat someone else's lunch. No one's going to give us anything for free. Of course, as you get bigger, that becomes a lot more difficult. So, yeah, everyone loves the word disruptive. I believe that far fewer people actually live and breathe a disruptive mindset. Okay.
Penultimate question, Tom. We've got the Euros around the corner, and you've spoken very passionately during this interview about building a major British brand. So would supplying the England football team, the Scottish football team, the Wales national team, would that be a natural ambition for you then?
The short answer, Kevin, is absolutely yes. So I spoke earlier about I can't be emotive about these partnerships. They have to be level-headed, data-driven decisions. I'm not a gambler. I'm not hoping this team might qualify for the Champions League and therefore I'll pay them a big fee and pray that they do qualify. You do not build a sustainably successful business by doing that. So we have to be very clear-headed, logical in our decision-making, believing that we can add value. Equally, I couldn't look you in the eye and say the chance as a kind of someone who started a business in England, who loves football, who loves sport, to one day be the partner of the national team, that would clearly be very, very special. So we do the Republic of Ireland at the moment, which is an amazing partnership for us. I guess to almost evidence what I just mentioned earlier about helping teams digitize their revenues, we sell significant volumes of product for Ireland in America. You've got huge cohorts of Irish Americans in Boston, Chicago, New York, that previously no one had really thought about. Well, how do we engage with that community? Castor has thought about that, and we have the infrastructure to help monetize and engage with that audience. So that partnership's been fantastic for us. The other countries in the British Isles, we've got an amazing partnership with Rangers. We've got a rugby partnership in Wales. We're ambitious, Kevin. So there's not a lot that we wouldn't look at and be excited about.
Do you know what, Tom? With hindsight, asking a kit manufacturer whether they'd like to eventually supply the England kit is probably the daftest question I've ever asked. It's also another indication that I haven't got a business brain. Of course you want to supply the England kit. It's been fascinating talking to you, Tom. I love interviews where I get insight and I learn stuff that I didn't know beforehand. I'm going to ask you the final question anyway, although I suspect that I know the answer to it already. Very early on, when you and your brother Phil were sitting around that kitchen table, you said that you dreamt of taking on the likes of Adidas and Nike. Are you enjoying the fight?
Oh, mate, I absolutely love it. I can't do justice with words. I love competing. I just love it, Kevin. You're never going to win every round. You're going to take a few punches. But I just love the competitive spirit, the ability to dust yourself down, get back up again, and try and achieve something like building a British brand that competes on the global stage. What an opportunity. I just absolutely love it. Every day when my alarm goes off, 5 a.m., I'm in the office by 5:30. I live and breathe it. There's nothing else I'd rather do.
Tom, it's been brilliant to talk to you. We wish you every success in the future. And we look forward to reading all about that. When you get the England kit, will you come back on and talk to us?
Absolutely, guys. No, very much appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much.
First of all, Keir, I should think we both got bowled away a little bit. And I think Tom's enthusiasm or near zeal for his subject, so much so that as we finished, he said, "Oh my God, I forgot to mention that we do the kit for Bayer Leverkusen, and we're about to go unbeaten the whole season in the Bundesliga," which also, you know, plays into his argument. We did discuss a few bumps in his road of Newcastle United ending the contract early with them, Aston Villa with the famous heavy shirt. So clearly, as he says, Leverkusen proves they're doing something right. But I thought it was amazing. And I have to say, the thing that most impressed me, Kieran, and I did say this during the interview, it's partly a corollary of the fact that I have no... That's not fiddly, is it?
No.
Are you hiding in a broom cupboard, Kieran?
I am, yes.
Do you know, it does look like you're hiding. I haven't taken due cognizance of where you are at the moment, Kieran, but yes. As I mentioned in the interview, it's a corollary of the fact that business and I are strangers, but I was fascinated by this notion that looking for investors is not a continuous process. And I was fascinated by the conversation you had about being focused on profit and cash, which I assumed was surely rule number one in business.
No, he was... I was worshipping at the Church of Tom, I'll be honest with you, because everything that I preach as a teacher, which is... As he says, it's a glib saying that I come out with all the time. Revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, cash is reality. But I don't know whether it works in the real world. Well, when he said, "Yeah, that's what we do. It's not about selling as many as you can. It's about making money." And yeah, that's where the Premier League has got it wrong, in the sense that Premier League revenues are up 2,800% and Premier League wages are up 3,800%. And that's why they're all losing money hand over fist, because all of the focus is on bringing money in and none of the focus is on controlling your costs. So to hear somebody that A, has applied that, and B, has turned a business effectively designed on his, you know, on his mum and dad's kitchen table with his brother, to a £100 million a year business, and it's growing, growing, growing. And he told us some stuff about who they're hoping to partner with, which clearly we can't reveal at this particular stage, was genuinely inspirational.
Yeah, I love comedy, Kieran. I love what I do. And sometimes I love it enough to still be up at 5:30 in the morning. I don't think I've ever loved it enough to get up at 5:30 in the morning, as he looks forward to doing. But I was also very interested in how he talked about the responsibility of having employees, the responsibility of paying 500 staff on time and being aware of their mortgages. And I suppose that relates a little bit to some of the football owners that we've talked about this year who clearly don't feel that same responsibility, who don't seem to have a second thought about not paying their staff on time.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, on a day when two clubs in the EFL have been given points deductions,
yeah,
since we recorded the show this morning with him. It's great to hear somebody who, A, is proud of being an entrepreneur, because it is a bit of a dirty word, I think, in the eyes of some, but his comments were transformational, but also being a responsible employer and not being able to sleep at night, if there is a genuine fear, and working his trolleys off to make sure that everything is paid on time, because he says, "I'm responsible for those, their families, I'm responsible for their pensions, and I take my role seriously."
Yeah, we'll be talking about those points deduction in detail on Monday's questions pod. We'll be starting it with the news of those EFL clubs having points deducted. You're absolutely right about the word entrepreneurs. I think we all watch programmes like The Apprentice, and we don't really take ourselves seriously as entrepreneurs in this country. We sort of laugh at them. But what impressed me, and I was genuinely impressed by this afterwards, Kieran, is this man, this driven man, this successful man, still has time to actually listen to our podcast every week, which I thought, I was walking down the road afterwards, heading towards a train. I just thought, actually, that's a feather in our cap, Kieran. So we know people in the industry listen to us. That's great, and we know we've got a worldwide fan base of football fans and accountants. But it's actually really quite impressive that somebody working at that level still finds time to listen to us two old sods wittering on.
and it's quite humbling. And I really would encourage anybody that knows anybody that's learning in a business school or is thinking of setting up their business to listen to this podcast. And we're not out here to sell the podcast. If you're thinking of at any time of going it alone, you've got an idea, you've got a passion, listen to him and you'll pick up a good few tips.
Yeah, we better draw this to a close, Kim, as I'm worried that the caretaker's going to come along and lock you in that broom cupboard.
And it's going to Hong Kong Fui as well.
I don't want to be the one who has to phone the Baroness up and say, I'm sorry about this. I know you're expecting him later on, but he's in the broom cupboard just for the moment. There's also, knowing the Baroness will probably just go, oh, not again. Anyway, thanks to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod as well, that'd be very kind of you to get you access to our chat community and our regular quizzes. And you can do that by going to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you do it soon enough, you'll be able to take part in our end of season quiz, which is coming up very soon. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com, and you can go to that same website address to get our latest book. Or if you want to wait for a couple of months and get it at the paperback price, you can do that, as it's coming out in September in paperback. We will see you on Monday for our questions pod. Have a good weekend. I hope your football goes well. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.